Out. All right. Hello and welcome to the Canadian Orange Podcast. The Orange mission is to unite Canada around the core problem that we face as a country, which is broken money. And this podcast is a place for Canadians to have conversations about how fixing the money can fix Canada. My name's Nick, and I'm speaking to Seb in this episode. If this conversation resonates with you or offered you value, please consider sharing it with others or donating at CanadianOrangeParty.com to support the show. Current block height is 925,445. Hash rate is at 1,119 exahashes per second. And currently, one Canadian dollar, aka Canadian peso, buys you 778 sats. For those who don't know, a sat is a small fraction of a Bitcoin, and there's 100 million sats, short for Satoshis, in one Bitcoin. Seb, welcome.
Oh man, Caribou, it is such a pleasure. And I have to say, I did not know what your actual name was. So now I actually know what your name is. It's
There
nice
you
to
go.
Meet you, Nick. It is nice to meet you.
Likewise, Seb, I'm very excited to have this conversation today. I'm super grateful for your time. We were able to meet in person at the most recent Canadian Bitcoin conference. And it's always a little bit surreal when you've heard someone's voice, you know, for hours on podcasts, and you've read the material that they've written, to meet them in person. And I think the one cool thing about Bitcoiners is when you meet them in person, they're the exact person that showed up on the podcast, which I think sometimes outside of the Bitcoin sphere is not always the case. So I was, it was an honor to meet you. And to those who don't know Seb, his last name is Bunny with two N's. He's written several great books, and he's an awesome human with lots of thoughtful insights to share. I'm sure he'll be humble and maybe say that's not the case, but my opinion is the only one that matters in this case. And yeah, I just want to take a second to frame up the question. And then my hope is to just mostly listen and have you share your perspective for the remainder of the hour. Because like I said, I've heard you speak, you have really thoughtful opinions to share. And I'm excited to hear them. And so, you know, most Canadians haven't yet done their homework to understand money. And so I think many of them can't really imagine how sound money potentially changes society in Canada for the better. And my hope is that conversations like this offer hope and motivation to Canadians to explore sound money, to see how sound money can have a positive impact in their life, and to eventually contribute to a better Canada by advocating for the restoration of sound money in this country. And so my question is, from your viewpoint, how does a return to sound money change Canada for the better? It's a really broad question. You can go wherever you please. I'll follow along and reflect on points or ask questions as the opportunity arises, but the floor is yours. You can go wherever you want with it.
Oh man. And you know what? I want to bring up one quick point, which you mentioned, just meeting people in person. And I find this digital space is such a funny place because you can listen to someone for hours and hours and hours, and you can get to know someone intimately. And I think the more you listen to someone's podcast, you get little snippets about their life and how they show up and their personality. And so it's just such a pleasure when you come along to these events and you meet someone who, as you say, you've listened to for hours, and it's almost like you've already built a bond. And so that's one of the most amazing things about Bitcoin is you meet these individuals, and many times you've only met them once or twice. You've maybe had a couple DMs back and forth, and already it's just such a tight-knit community. And so I just feel so unbelievably grateful to just be a part of this community and just for the information you shared at the start.
Agreed. I always feel like a hug in person is the required element to close the loop of really getting to know someone. And I think in 2D or through audio, you can get like 95% the way there, especially if people are really speaking from the heart candidly. But that in-person connection where you meet is just like a required element to really fulfill that loop of actually being able to experience someone's presence. So, sorry to interrupt.
No, I could not agree more. Could not agree more. So where to take this conversation? Oh my God. Okay. I am thinking, basically, at the Canadian Bitcoin conference, and I've only given this presentation once, and they didn't even record it at the Canadian Bitcoin conference. And so I kind of want to take the presentation in the direction of this presentation, or sorry, take this conversation in the direction of the presentation that I gave during the Canadian Bitcoin conference. And it kind of really just starts with this idea of, do we see reality as it is? And so many times when we talk about money, we talk about how money impacts us from obviously a financial lens, but we don't necessarily tie money back to other areas of our society, such as like the sciences, biology and chemistry and physics and such. And so At its heart, I want to kind of frame this idea with, do we see reality as it is? And what, how does like the money we use today, broken money, fiat money, distort our ability to see reality as it is? And so I want to start by kind of just saying that all of us navigate this world using maps. Those maps can be the maps of our relationships. They can be the maps of food. What do we think is healthy? What do we think is unhealthy? The maps of money. How do we think money is meant to operate? Is it meant to be centralized? Is inflation just natural and prices just rise over time? And then we have all of the maps of physics and biology and chemistry. And we have things like the laws of thermodynamics that tell us how the world operates. But I think what sometimes we get kind of caught up in, and bear with me because I'm going to bring this all the way back to Bitcoin, but we're going to go on a bit of a tangent first. I think
Ready.
that when it comes to these maps at which we navigate this world, the physics, the sciences, relationships, money, food, we have this perspective on how we think the world works. But all of these things are really just maps. And there's a famous quote, one of my favorite quotes, and it's called, "The map is not the territory." And this quote, basically what it implies is a map is just a representation of reality. It will never be reality. And so if I'm at my local ski resort and I'm looking up the hill and I have the map of the ski resort in front of me, if I see this ridge line on the map and then I'm looking up and that ridge line isn't there, then what that indicates is my map is incorrect and all of a sudden I'm lost. How am I going to be able to navigate this terrain? How am I going to be able to move through this terrain? Because my map does not represent reality. And so it impedes us in being able to show up. And so the same is true for things like relationships. Many times we see our parents, how they interact with one another. And now we go and explore this world, dive into these romantic relationships, and many times repeat a lot of the behaviors our parents were repeating. And then we realize, huh, this isn't working. So what do? We redraw the map, and all of a sudden our relationships improve. The same thing is with food. We think, oh, this is what is healthy. Maybe I should be eating vegan. Maybe I should be eating greens. And then we realize, I'm not really feeling that good. We do a little bit of research. Huh, our ancestors have been eating meat for as long as I can remember. And so maybe I should be eating meat. Oh, I feel way better. So we redraw that map. And it's the same thing with money. We've been told the world prices rise naturally. You need a centralized entity controlling money. And what's interesting is when you go down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin, you start to recognize maybe we don't need a centralized entity governing our monetary system. Maybe inflation isn't natural. Maybe prices should fall over time. And so we start to redraw these maps and our world becomes brighter. All of a sudden, we're able to navigate this world more effectively because our maps are more accurate to the territory. But I want to kind of go on this tangent, kind of down the sciences. And what's really fascinating is when you start kind of digging into science, there's certain things that are kind of being told as truths. There's things like the laws of thermodynamics. The first law is the conservation of energy. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. The second law is the law of entropy. Every time energy changes form, some of it is lost. So if you've got a wheel to get forward motion, you may have friction and heat, and that obviously dissipates energy. Now, why am I saying this? I'm saying this because if you go dig through kind of the archives of YouTube and you go try and like scour the internet, you start coming across videos about what are called perpetual motion machines. Now, perpetual motion machines essentially are machines that you can get more energy output than the energy input. Now, that completely defies the laws of thermodynamics. Our laws say that this is not possible. We cannot go and create perpetual energy machines. But there are many of these machines and these videos of individuals creating these machines and being able to generate energy from a tiny, tiny input source. Not only that, people can even test this stuff themselves. If you go and get a tube and you go and rub a hydrophobic like gel on the inside of the tube and then you put the tube in water, the tube starts cycling water. And that cycling water indefinitely, you've just created a perpetual motion machine. You've created the movement of something which, if you had the technology, you could capture that movement to generate energy, but the hydrophobic material is constantly pushing water through this thing indefinitely. So what's really interesting is it starts to get you questioning. Huh, these maps that we are using, these maps of the sciences, well, we're told these are, say, the laws of thermodynamics, but what if they're really not laws and actually they're just theories? And what if our map to these sciences isn't necessarily as accurate as it could be? Now, at its root, I believe that money is what is causing this. And we're going to get to that in a little moment, but I want to, again, like take you down a little bit of like a story first, because I think it'll make more sense to fill this in. So it kind of brings up this idea. Most of us kind of tend to assume that the maps we use today, so the maps of the sciences, are the best approximation of reality given the information we have. But what if this is not necessarily true? What if they are skewed, usually for control purposes? And there's many examples of individuals using maps, skewing maps for control purposes. One that stands out to me is North Korea. North Korea, like if you actually go and dig into North Korea and kind of how it's formed over time and where it is right now, as most people know, North Korea is built on kind of Marxist ideologies. And the Kim family, Kim Il Sung, what is it? Kim Jong Il, Kim Il Sung, the Kim family, they built this kind of control structures built on these Marxist principles, and they call it the Juche ideology. Now, the Juche ideology, what is really fascinating, is all about linguistic control. And linguistic control basically means if you control the language, you control someone's experience. Well, language is just a map. It's a map for our experiences of how we're moving through this world. We use words to describe our experience. Well, with this Juche ideology, there are no words for liberation. There's no words for freedom. There's no words for love my partner. There's no words for love my kids. There's only words for I love my leader and work harder and such. And so all of a sudden, when you are governing the language, you are impeding people's ability to experience what's actually going on. And so this to me is fascinating. It's highlighting that the map is not representing the territory. You're experiencing things, but you don't have words to describe it. So it's altering your experience. And so this is a perfect example where someone is controlling the map, which is altering someone's experience. If you can't describe freedom, if you can't describe liberation, if you can't describe stress because you're tired, you're beat down, how do you experience those things? So that brings me on to kind of the next stage, which is if our maps are being controlled or governed, is there any evidence of this? And I would say, yes, there's a ton of evidence of this. There is in the US. In 1951, there was something called the Invention Secrecy Act. And the Invention Secrecy Act basically enabled the US government to issue a secrecy order on any patent application for national security reasons, preventing inventors from disclosing, selling, or commercializing any of their inventions. And so most people don't hear about this. And so Congress pushed this through in 1951. And as of 2024, there's 6,741 secrecy orders in effect. So you've got to think about like, what technology could we have access to as a society that could profoundly change the world we live in, but we don't gain access to that technology because it's been suppressed through these secrecy orders? And there are little glimpses of potentially these technologies showing through and then being suppressed. One of them in particular, there's a guy called Stan Meyer. And so Stan Meyer in 51, no, sorry, a little later, in 98, what he ended up kind of releasing was a water-powered car. And this water-powered car on 4 liters of water gained 180 kilometers of range, which is like mind-blowing. We don't have water-powered cars. Anyway, he went to a restaurant to go do a deal with some licensees to license this. And if I remember correctly, I think it may have been with Volkswagen he was trying to do a deal with so that they were able to kind of push out a water-powered car. And he stood up. And he basically said, they've poisoned me, he ran out of the restaurant, he died on the street, and all of a sudden the patent disappeared from the patent office. And that technology never made it to kind of the world we live in today. And so there's a lot of this technology that is basically, it is invented, created, discovered, and we just never really gain access to it. And there's a lot of individuals as well that talk about this. One in particular is Eric Weinstein. So Eric Weinstein, if you ever dig into kind of this individual, he's like a mathematician, physicist. He's a phenomenal individual and really amazing podcasts. But he kind of coined this term, the distributed idea suppression complex. And the distributed idea suppression context, well, complex, the way I interpret it, is it's basically this idea that technology cannot advance in the way that we think it should advance, which is people are tinkering, people are able to innovate, technology advances, we become more efficient, we become more productive, because there are kind of these barriers that impede it. And in my mind, there's kind of five of these. The first one is government funding. 50 to 70% of almost every single science sector, the government fund, the funding for such research comes from the government. So immediately, if you are not doing something which the government agrees upon, you're just not going to receive funding. You're not going to be able to dive into those endeavors. That technology is never going to be seen. So that's the first step. The second step is kind of regulatory oversight. You then have all of these bodies that kind of oversee these technologies, these advancements, this research, and they tell you what you can and can't dig into. And Eric Weinstein talks about how after the atomic bomb project, the Manhattan Project, the government put through legislation that basically made it illegal to even think about certain types of physics. And so it's just like, this is mind blowing. Like, we've supposedly got freedom of speech, but we don't, because there's certain types of physics we're not even allowed to discuss. We can't even think about these things through threat of going to prison. And so you've got these regulatory bodies that basically govern what we're allowed to talk about, what we're not allowed to talk about, and what direction industry is going. Third, we have the scientific journals. We have these centralized scientific journals, which, as most people know, if you want to kind of get your research known, you kind of have to be in the scientific journals. They have to be peer-reviewed. These scientific journals have recommended readings for most of kind of the various universities and students and such. And so it's very hard for your research to be known if you don't make it into the scientific journals. Well, the scientific journals are centrally controlled and they govern what goes into those journals. Fourth, you have the peer review system. The peer review system, to even get into the scientific journals, you tend to need to have whatever research you're doing peer reviewed. But what does that mean? It means that you're being reviewed by a peer in your industry, which also means that if you're releasing some form of technology that goes against the status quo or impacts their bottom line, they're just not going to review your research because it materially impacts them. So you can't even get into the journals because of the peer review system, which basically blocks scientific advancement, which then leads us to the fifth area, which is kind of the cultural and career incentives, which is if you're an individual, naturally, evolutionarily, we want to be part of our tribe. If we get ostracized from our tribe, we're probably going to die. Well, today we're no longer going to die if we get ostracized from a tribe. But if you're a scientist or a researcher and you've just spent years in university and schooling to get to where you are, if you go against mainstream belief, you may have any of your qualifications removed. You may not be able to receive money because you're not able to receive any funding, which means you can't support your family. And so there's all of these various career and cultural incentives that impede your ability to basically be able to direct your energy into the things you're curious about and these other areas of science that hopefully would be able to more greatly align our map to the territory. So we've kind of discussed this idea so far that there are a lot of control structures in place, North Korea being one of them, which have shown that they're willing to control the map to be able to alter people's experience as they walk through the territory. Then we've seen governments come out and say, hey, we're going to suppress any technology that could impede us in being able to show up. We're not going to allow you to see any of this. And then you've got all of these suppression complexes, which basically impede people being curious and going down certain avenues. So to me, it kind of brings up this question. It's just like, why would someone want to curate the map? Why would they go to such great lengths to curate the map? And ultimately, I would say that the reason why people want to curate the map, governments, regulatory bodies, and such, is that maps are curated because control depends on perception. Throughout history, wars have been fought over resources. Whoever essentially controls the flow of energy, controls the flow of money, controls the flow of information, essentially just controls the world. And so the system isn't broken by accident. It's designed to preserve that control. And so if resources are scarce, power stays concentrated. And so the maps we're given, whether it is about energy, money, reality itself, aren't necessarily wrong, but they're conveniently incomplete and they don't allow us to see certain areas of the world around us. And you think about it from an energy perspective, if we indeed had perpetual energy machines, what that means is we have abundance in energy. That means that we don't have to worry about fresh water because we can desalinate seawater. We don't have to worry about food because we have abundance in energy to be able to grow whatever it is that we need. We don't need to worry about being able to heat our homes or people dying from cold exposure or heat exposure because we have abundance in AC and heating because energy is abundant. But control depends on scarcity, energy scarcity. A lot of the corporations that govern our world today, unfortunately, are in their positions of power because they control the flow of these resources, whether it is oil, whether it is access to other resources, mining materials, heavy metals, things like this. And so ultimately, I think that the maps we use today are heavily, heavily controlled. And so this kind of brings us full circle back to Bitcoin. What does Bitcoin kind of have to do with any of this kind of stuff? And the way that I see it is that if we kind of like drop away a lot of the complexity of how Bitcoin actually works, and let's just go back to kind of basics, Bitcoin is absolutely scarce. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. And so in my mind, what that does is because no entity can go and print money and take value from one another party, it means that it forces a free market. It means that if you want to obtain Bitcoin, you have to create value because Bitcoin can no longer be seized through coercion and force as effectively as money has been able to historically. And so if we have a free market where capital flows to where value is being created, what that does in my mind is realign a lot of the monetary incentives. And so if we look at the two entities for these monetary incentive realignment, we've kind of got government and then we've got individuals. So from the government side of things, if the government can no longer just print money, fund operations, what does it have to do? It has to listen to the populace. It has to be fiscally responsible. And what that means is that if it is spending frivolously and is running massive deficits, it's just going to wither away and its opposition or someone else is going to rise up. But it also means that if they have to be fiscally responsible, they've got to start thinking long term. And so they've got to start thinking about, okay, what are our biggest expenses on the balance sheet? Well, our biggest expenses right now are probably healthcare and energy costs. It's being able to run this economy and it's being able to actually just support the health of our economy. And so I think that we're going to start to see incentives realign towards, okay, if energy costs are our biggest expenditure, maybe if we have a little bit of excess capital, we're actually going to direct this capital towards actual research that can progress the energy sector towards looking into ways that we can create more abundant energy, because now the incentives are realigned towards the government listening to the people, given that they're funded by the people. And then you look at it from the individual perspective, and I think that if individuals, if life is starting to get easier because their cost of living is falling instead of rising, they're starting to get more capacity, then what does that mean? It means that they have a greater capacity to look inwards and say, how do I want to show up? What is it that motivates me? What is it that's important to me? And I think that if people have more capacity and they're not constantly figuring out how do I put food on the table, how do I kind of where's my next paycheck coming from? How am I going to be able to support my kids? Ultimately, with more curiosity, I think we start to see people diving into things that they're passionate about. And I think that if people are diving into things they're passionate about and monetary, like the money side of things flows a little more easily, I think we're going to see a lot more private funding of research, a lot less government funding of research. And so hopefully these sciences can start to advance more naturally as opposed to them being capped, kneecapped by these regulatory agencies, by the flow of capital from government. And ultimately, I think that that realigns the incentives more towards prosperity. And that to me is huge because if we have the end of energy scarcity, I think that what we're going to see is manufacturing, logistics, housing, all of these shortages, all of these issues start to collapse. As I mentioned, we're going to see food for all because starvation, drought, all of these things become engineering problems now that we actually have abundance of energy. And then we're also going to see a lot of this environmental regeneration, because I think that we're no longer just going to burn and extract resources from a natural environment to survive. And so we can have kind of ecosystem repair, and it just becomes far more economically viable. And then finally, I think that we're just going to see massive technological acceleration just because computing without cost, AI, space exploration, medical research could expand at just like unbelievable rates because we have abundance in energy and such. And so I genuinely believe that like if we can just fix our money, we can fix a lot of these like misaligned incentives that kind of basically create these control structures. I believe we can see reality more clearly, and it's that clarity that ultimately drives discovery. And so, in the end, I kind of ended this little presentation when I was in this conference with I genuinely believe that Bitcoiners are the cartographers of this kind of new reality, and this new reality kind of grounded in truth, not illusion, where we're kind of redrawing these maps. And maps will never be the territory, but in an ideal world, the map is always the best representation of the territory given the information we've got. At the moment, our maps are not the best representation of the territory. They're skewed and they're distorted to maintain control structures and, in many ways, hide reality as it is. Anyway, there's my little ramble. I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
That was so good. You've got that dialed. And it's such a, I mean, I come from a background in healthcare, and the companies that I work with have a big emphasis on story because I think story and play are the two OG learning tools that humans have leveraged forever, and they've just kind of withered away and we've forgotten about them. And I think a resurgence in story and a resurgence in play is how we're gonna kind of get people to really understand, like you say, reality and be able to experience reality.
I
I
was
mean,
actually, you know what? Like, as you're saying that, there is, and I wonder if I can find it quickly. There's a book I absolutely love. And one of my other passions, and I didn't really share this, is I find diving into how we grow as individuals, how we develop as children, the traumas and how it shapes us as individuals. There's a book that I wholeheartedly would put a lot of weight on by saying that it has profoundly changed how I think about illness and health. And one of the little quotes in this book, it's called The Body Keeps the Score. It says, if an organism is stuck in survival mode, its energies are focused on fighting off unseen enemies, which leaves no room for nurture, care, and love. For us humans, it means that as long as the mind is defending itself against invisible assaults, our closest bonds are threatened, along with our ability to imagine, plan, play, learn, and pay attention to other people's needs. And now I say that because you said this term play. And I think that it's really sad. Like the world we live in today, more and more and more of our capacity is going towards survival and simply just trying to put food on the table and a roof over our heads. And less of that capacity is going towards this imagine, this planning, this playing, this learning, this pay attention to the world around us. And I think that ultimately, what actually brings us joy in society, what brings us joy as individuals, is when we're able to connect with others, when we're able to challenge ourselves, when we're able to actually like play and dive into these passions as opposed to just being stuck in this survival space. And so I think that money is creating all of these unseen enemies, as the kind of quote describes, which are basically just preventing us from showing up more authentically and directing our energy where we see fit.
Agreed. That's a powerful book. I think it's Bessel van der Kolk. I re read it a while ago. Probably need to revisit it. That's going to be my prompt to revisit it. But yeah, I think we live in such a culture that glorifies work and undervalues play. Because play is actually, I think adults will see play as something frivolous or a waste of time, but actually play can be quite serious, and play can be a really productive use of time. And I think we've just gotten away from that in a culture where we have to do more and more for less and less. Therefore, work overtakes our sort of schema of what's important. Because frankly, when your time's being constantly stolen, work ends up being primary. As you say, we get kind of launched into survival mode, and our creativity gets killed. Our ability to just reflect on life and what's important and what we're doing and meaning kind of gets put into the background perpetually if we're constantly being stolen from. And I think there's this idea. I mean, what really came to mind as you were saying all that is this idea that if fraudulent currency can be printed by governments at zero cost, they have unlimited resources to maintain the illusion and facade of these fraudulent maps. And there's no limit to the amount of financial currency, financial energy that's still being acknowledged as real by most people. That they can inject into the system to maintain these illusions, to maintain the narrative, right? Like in Canada, we're one of the most highly propagandized people in the world. It kind of gets forgotten because Canada's like, oh, this nice friendly place, and people think we have democracy, people think we have free healthcare, like all these weird false ideas and narratives that are just propagated because people either don't have the bandwidth to look into it, although you see with Bitcoiners, like they're seeing through all these fake maps. And they're drawing, like you said, I love that term. Bitcoiners are their cartographers of reality because they've been able to pierce through the veil of the illusion, go deep in terms of their understanding. I mean, to really understand money at a deep level, you kind of have to puncture through a lot of the other more superficial maps, like health, like education, like politics. And when you get down to the base and see, well, if the foundational layer is corrupted, everything above it is corrupted. Right. If the money is a lie and it's a fraud, every map that's built on top of that fraudulent money becomes a fraudulent map, becomes an illusion. And, to those who haven't really done their homework to understand that this trope of fix the money, fix the world, or, Canadian Orange Party, the mantra is fix the money, fix Canada, seems like a simplistic, hyperbolic statement that doesn't really, that's kind of like a silly thing to say. But for the people who've actually done the work and gotten down to the base incentives, it actually is true. And it's not necessarily that if we switch to sound money tomorrow, all the problems are fixed, but by changing the fundamental incentives, all of the outcomes move in the direction of improvement when you actually restore a free market. And I love Jeff Booth's saying of, when you have abundant money, you have scarcity everywhere. When you have scarce money, you have abundance everywhere. And I think you can apply that to curiosity, right? If you have abundance in money, you have a scarcity in curiosity because people don't have the opportunity to exercise their curiosity or reconnect with it. And for me, I have a 2-year-old daughter, and that has really allowed me to kind of step into this idea of childlike curiosity and exploring without the constraints that have been imposed in all these schemas and stories that have been updated in my software as an adult going through the traditional education system or living within this weird map. And it's funny because some people are at the point, it seems like a lot of people now, that there's so much pain being inflicted by fraudulent currency, where they're like, ah, something doesn't feel right. I see what I'm being told, and then I see what's actually happening, and there's a massive disconnect. They haven't really maybe gotten to the point where they realize the map is just a straight up fraud and they have to do the work themselves. But I think people are gradually accepting that they need to take on more responsibility for truth, because the easy way of just doing what you're told, doing what your doctor tells you, listening to what your politicians are telling you, like the numbers aren't matching up anymore, right? It's like you can only be told to not believe your own eyes for so long until you're like, this isn't enough's enough. I need to actually explore what is going on here because what I'm being told is not true. And so, maybe one thing I like to ask Bitcoiners is how has transitioning to sound money changed your life fundamentally? Because I think while we can't necessarily extrapolate your story to what's going to happen to other people and what's going to happen collectively to a society, there is an element of truth whereby if you ask 100 Bitcoiners how their lives improved when they switched to sound money, you're going to get these like threads that are very common amongst everyone. And you can, with a high degree of probability, say, well, that's probably going to be something similar that happens to other people in their own respective way. And whether that's, I started taking care of myself more. I started wanting to have a family. I started eating better, like all these things. So I'd love to know from your perspective, if you can go back and imagine Seb, who just started learning about sound money and was starting to transition his life to a sound money standard, looking through that lens, living in alignment with sound money. How has it fundamentally changed your life? How did it change your behaviors, your outlook? I'd love to know, maybe little nuggets that you can remember from along the way.
Yeah, so it's really interesting you ask this question because I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and this is actually an article that I've taken down a few notes and I want to write this article because I think that's a really important thing to discuss. And the way that I'll kind of frame it is that there's so many videos out there of wealthy individuals, celebrities, you name it, actors, mathematicians, physicists, whatever, they've done unbelievable things in their lifetime. And they would always say, I'll be happy when. I'll be happy when. When this thing arrives, when I can buy the ranch, when I achieve this type of status, when I get this much money, when I have $10 million, you name it. I'll be happy when. And what's really interesting is these individuals, they get to this place where they achieve that because they've had unbelievable amounts of success in their life. And what do they say? I'm not happy. I've got these things that I thought this was going to make me happy, and I've got these things and I'm not happy. And what is happiness? And so they start to self-reflect. Well, what's really interesting is they went through this unbelievable amount of success to be able to have that realization. What's amazing about Bitcoin is that Bitcoin, because of its kind of supply and its previous historical appreciation and where people think it's going price-wise, all of a sudden it brings forward your future where people are like, they come into it for number go up technology. They start to realize, man, maybe in like 3 or 4 years I can actually buy the house. Maybe I can do all of these things that I didn't actually think were possible. And so what happens is you start to get this hope. And so you start to plan for the future. You start to plan for this world where you have a lot more abundance. And then what ends up happening is Bitcoin's price basically takes a massive dive because Bitcoin is volatile. And all of a sudden, you start to recognize just how attached you are to the price of Bitcoin. And then, as you recognize how attached you are to the price of Bitcoin, it sends you on this reflection journey. And so, what I've found so amazing about Bitcoin is it's almost like Bitcoin gives you the capacity to go on this self-reflection journey because you've had this relationship with money without ever actually needing to achieve the full success that these celebrities and such have done to have that same self-reflection journey. And so Bitcoiners, they start out with number go up technology, and then all of a sudden they go on this personal journey recognizing that actually happiness comes from within. Happiness comes from our connections to our community, our connections to our partner, our connections to those that we care about and our family. It comes from being able to dive into things we're passionate about. It comes from being able to contribute back to society. It comes from just kind of building the self-esteem to be able to show up authentically. And so, what I've just found so interesting about Bitcoin is the further I go along this journey, the less and less and less attached to this thing Bitcoin I become, and more aware of how I'm showing up as an individual and recognizing what is just like so important to actually drive true happiness. Because we're being pushed externally from this external world we live in. We're constantly being pushed all of these things, these metrics that no, success and happiness come from money. Success and happiness come from the newest this, the newest that, the Lamborghini, the Rolex watch, and it really does not. And I think that Bitcoin gives us a glimpse at that realization without having to actually achieve all of the success and the wealth, just because it gives us the hope that actually we may be able to even achieve some of those things. And so it's kind of sent me on this internal journey. And when I've spoken to a lot of Bitcoiners, they've also experienced something similar in a way. It's just kind of created so much more self-reflection. And so something that I kind of end up saying is that like the irony of Bitcoin being digital money is that it actually gets us to stop thinking about money, because the money we use today, because it's declining purchasing power, creating a rising cost of living, making life harder, is we're always constantly fixated on money. Whereas Bitcoin gets us to kind of stop thinking about money and recognizing what's important to each and every one of us.
It's really well said. I heard you say that a while ago. I've been saying it and quoting you on that because it is an irony, right? It's like when you fix the money, ironically, it allows us to stop thinking about money because it doesn't constantly grab at our attention and energy. Whereas broken money that constantly degrades constantly requires us to allocate energy towards it because we have to figure out how to make more of it just to not fall backwards. And yeah, I think it really. Again, these sound hyperbolic to those who maybe haven't gone down this journey, but just try it and you'll experience it for yourself. Don't trust Verify. Bitcoin is almost like this tool of personal transformation. And if Canada as a nation is just a collection of individuals, the path to change is not actually to try and influence the politicians that are in this weird fiat altered reality. It is actually just to focus on change at the individual level, facilitated by the acceptance and adoption of sound money on a personal level, that transformation results in a collective transformation over time. And so it's almost, sometimes I hear people talk about a hyper-Bitcoinized world as like this thing that's going to happen in the future. And it's like, I see it happening on an individual level, which is really the only level that really matters because when it hits an inflection point and enough individuals have transitioned, then we kind of have this soft transition as a whole, as a nation, as a world. But it really is, it's like almost baked into Bitcoin, this idea that there are these volatile periods, is this 4-year hero's journey that we all go through through cycles. And the beauty is you don't have to, like you said, you don't have to spend a lifetime to get all the things you've ever wanted and maybe have the realization that maybe you wanted the wrong things, right? When you get all the things you ever wanted and you're not happy, you kind of come to this realization that, wow, it turns out I wanted the wrong things. And what do I actually want? What actually matters? Some people take a lifetime to discover that. And Bitcoin is almost thrust into this approximate 4-year window that repeats and allows you to review that on a personal level every 4 years, effectively. And maybe those 4-year kind of, sections of time won't hold true. But I think for me, it's almost like every 4 years, every time I experience, my net worth take a nosedive, it reinforces the idea that actually that's not really what matters, right? It's like what actually matters is my health. How much of my time do I have control over because I don't have these obligations that I'm forced to meet? How much of the work I do feels like play because I actually want to intrinsically do it, not just doing it for an external reward. And it's like the ultimate self-reflection tool, or it has been for me. And I think helping people adopt Bitcoin is about helping offer them the opportunity to have the bandwidth, space, and time to self-reflect on like what actually matters to them. What do they care about? What motivates them? What maps did they want to look into to kind of go through the illusion and actually see truth and reality? And it's not a smooth journey. When I think it was an Ayn Rand quote, you can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality. And I think the more disconnected we get from reality, it's almost the metaphor I use is we hold on to this balloon. Reality is us standing our 2 feet planted on the ground. You hold on to this balloon, the balloon gets injected with helium. You have enough helium, and helium is false assumptions, false narratives, bad maps. You get enough of these bad maps, you start to float upward. The higher you float, the more it hurts when you fall back down to reality. And I feel like in Canada, we've drifted really far collectively from reality. And so people are going to get smacked up when they get back to reality. But would you rather live, that The Matrix is such a deep movie. Now that I look at it, I like watch it every couple of years, and it's like, whoa, it's eerily, it seems like a documentary. And that area where the guy's like, I see the girl in the red dress. I know she's not real. I'm eating the steak. It tastes so good, but I know it's not real. Yeah, I could go to base reality, but it just feels so good and comfortable. Like, why would I stop? That is the fundamental choice that I think most people are going to have. And maybe it takes more and more pain in this altered reality that seems comfortable initially to nudge people to do the uncomfortable thing, which is you need to drop all the maps that you've adopted as truth for your whole life, and you need to begin taking responsibility to redraw new maps. Good news is a lot of people who already are operating on base reality maps that you can go talk to and build community with and uploaded a lot of their maps that they've already gone out and proofed the trails, and they've verified that map with peers. And so, it's not, you don't just want to accept it tacitly without doing your own work. But I think it, once you get through the discomfort that you've been deceived and stolen from your whole life, and you accept that, there's like a deep sense of grief almost. But with the acceptance comes the opening of the door to actually experience life in reality and have a way better life on the other side by living in a monetary system that makes life easier for you exponentially as time goes on, instead of making life exponentially more difficult.
Oh man, I could not agree more. And I think that Ayn Rand quote, like you can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequence of ignoring reality. I think that what comes to mind as you're saying that is that we can, the further we go down this path of ignoring reality, the more painful it comes to get back on track. And so like we've seen it with like Yellowstone, like the national park in the US is a perfect example. Most people have heard of kind of the forest fires back in 60s and 70s, where they're like, you know what? We don't want to have a forest fire. We need to preserve this place. We need to preserve like the amazing beauty in this place. And so what do? They put a very strict forest fire suppression kind of approach in place. And any single time there was a tiny little forest fire, they put it out. All of the little brush fires, they put them out. And so what it meant was that this kindling accumulated and accumulated and accumulated. And then in and around, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was kind of around maybe the 80s, they had a forest fire that burnt down one third of the whole park. And it was because they were getting further and further away from reality because they weren't allowing these little brush fires, which are a necessity to kind of clean through and regenerate the soil and put nutrients back in the soil. And we see the same thing in society with our governments, where we go through hard times. But instead of allowing those hard times to create strong men, what do? We cut interest rates, we incentivize borrowing, we stimulate the economy of more money. And all of these individuals who have been fiscally responsible that have caused us to go into these hard times, we've now just incentivized them to take out more debt and to be able to continue doing their behavior. And so basically what's happening is we're trying to perpetuate this good times, but this good times, as the famous saying goes, creates weak men. And we end up with a society that really starts breaking down. And I think that right now we're feeling all of this fraying around the edges. Like people are losing themselves. They don't quite understand, like, why am I feeling just so disconnected? Why do I feel like I'm not adding value to society? Why can't I spend time with my kids? Why is life getting so expensive? Why are we having these massive housing crises? Why there's just like there's so much demand for everything and prices are skyrocketing? And at the root of it, it's because we're constantly band-aiding any of the symptoms and we're trying to impede things from a monetary perspective.
Yeah, and central planning never works. Free markets are more intelligent than any central planner can ever pretend to be. And it seems like we just have to experience the consequences of central planning to accept that reality. instead of just being able to understand that that is the truth, right? Like, I feel like people not knowing history is a big part of why we got to where we got to, right? And even someone recently told me history is just his story. It's just one person's story, right? You don't know if that's the truth. That's just the person who won telling the story in the way that probably benefited them. But this idea that central planning, that there's these people who are selected that go and wear suits and talk and call themselves honorable, like that's where the gaslighting starts, I feel. When you look in the House of Commons, people call themselves the honorable. It's like you don't have to. Honorable people don't need to constantly call themselves honorable. Like that's a red flag. But this idea that these politicians know better than all of Canadians and are making huge decisions on behalf of the population because they think they know better is just the most goofy thing ever. And I, you know, even the example I love to give people, and this is, I mean, that forest fire metaphor just holds true in so many ways. In the world of health, I used to use it all the time. It's like you're supposed to feel crappy sometimes because that's the nudge to change your behaviors. And if you paced over feeling crappy or these symptoms with a drug or with ignoring the problem or shrinking your movement capacity because you just can't move your knee there anymore, you eventually get to a place where a catastrophic injury happens or you have no capacity whatsoever. And you know, it's required. And this idea that, you know, a crappy airline like Air Canada has subpar service, super expensive, and during a hard time economically, they basically are going bankrupt. The government scoops in and rescues them. All it allows that to do is what really should happen in a free market. Air Canada goes bankrupt because they provide an inferior service. Their assets get liquidated. All the other airlines that are doing a better job scoop up Air Canada's assets, and they are able to offer better services to more people. It benefits everyone except for Air Canada, but the free market literally says, you didn't do a good job, you're not competitive, you die. By the government going in and bailing out Air Canada, so essentially you, me, and all of the Canadians paid to allow an inferior company to continue offering an inferior, overpriced, shitty product, it literally makes it worse for everyone, except for the people who are getting paid to offer an inferior service. And so, you know, this idea that there's always this virtuous story where we need to do this because it's better for us. We need to do this to save the climate or whatever, whatever the story is that the politicians tell us. It's just really sad that people accept those things, that people, and I think it's this weird feedback cycle where people's bandwidth shrinks more and more and more as money erodes away the time they have to actually think about how the world works and think about their life. And so their bandwidth to actually see things that are happening that are not good shrinks, and it allows the people who are currently manning the money printer to continue doing these weird things and paying to tell people a false narrative. They pay to continue reinforcing the false maps, as you say. And I think it, you know, every person individually has their own breaking point where pain becomes, it's like the pain of change becomes less than the current pain they're experiencing. And you know, I always go back to this idea that change happens through either curiosity or pain. And this idea that came from you, that fraudulent money kills curiosity because people don't have the bandwidth to be curious, means that pretty much all change has to happen through pain. And the sad reality is that we could have avoided mass pain and suffering on so many occasions, but it seems like, you know, some people are able to avoid it just through curiosity and through taking more responsibility for truth, namely Bitcoiners. And it's almost like every Bitcoiner gets to a point where they're like, I want to help other people develop curiosity, nurture their curiosity to avoid pain and suffering that is surely coming if they don't actually engage in that. And so what, you know, just to kind of finish off, what motivates you these days? Like, you know, you're writing books, you're doing podcasts like this, you're spending your time and energy helping other people improve their understanding of reality and draw better maps. What motivates you to do that? What keeps you know, because there's this weird theory where humans are not designed to be happy. And that primal instinct of not being happy is what pushes us to continue moving forward in life, continue doing things. I don't know if I buy that fully. It sounds like there's an element of truth to it. But what motivates you to keep going and doing more things now in the point in your life where, like, you know, I know a lot of Bitcoiners that are healthy. They have enough Bitcoin for them and their entire lineage. They frankly don't really need to do much. if they don't want to. But what I see is a lot of Bitcoiners are doing insane amounts of contribution. So where, why? I would just love to know your answer. What motivates you to keep doing this stuff?
That's again such a fascinating question. I would say that, like, at its core, we all have these certain traits about who we are and how we show up. And when I think about kind of a common thread throughout most of my life, as long as I can remember, all the way back when I was a kid, I loved trying to, like, teach and pass on knowledge to my peers. All the way through my teens into my 20s, for over a decade, I was a professional mountain bike coach. I'd be teaching, I've worked in the school district. I have obviously written books. I have written blog posts, started nonprofit educational platforms. Like, there's, to me, I get so much value out of sharing knowledge that maybe, just maybe, has that little bit of a spark that kind of creates curiosity in an individual and then just helps just reorient their path just slightly. Because I've seen how I've had a conversation here or a conversation there, or I've listened to a podcast here, or I've read this book there, and there's just been one little sentence in that book that has profoundly changed my life. Profoundly changed my life, because it's almost like it has given me a piece of the map that I didn't have, that then just makes so much more sense as to why I've been experiencing reality in the way that I've been experiencing it. And so ultimately, I'd just say the more people that I think put their self out there, and we democratize, decentralize this information so that everyone is being curious, I think the more prosperous we become as a society. Because I think the challenge, as we've been discussing, is that as money is breaking down and people have less capacity, what we start doing is we start putting off decision making onto the so-called experts. And we stop taking accountability for our lives. Well, I'm sick, I'm just gonna go to the doctor and I'm just gonna have a quick fix. Oh, I feel kind of like overweight, I'm just gonna take a pill for that. I'm not actually gonna look into what's healthy for me. Oh, my kids are struggling with school, I'm just gonna hire a tutor for that. And it's just like being able to actually recognize that life is not as complex as I think these so-called experts have made it seem. If you just do a little bit of research, you can learn about the history of food, the history of education, how we show up in the way that we do, how our systems, our economy functions. You can learn to a point where you can show up in a lot more accountable, sovereign way with a lot less information than society makes it seem. And so ultimately, it's just like, I think I do what I do because I love, one, it's a selfish pursuit seeing someone else also grow as an individual, but I love passing on knowledge. And hopefully, there's just a little glimmer of something I said that helps just support someone in their own trajectory.
Well, thank you for doing what you do, because it's the combination of many people taking that mindset that gives the opportunity for many other people to actually learn reality. And it seems like not only are we our Bitcoiners cartographers for their own lives and their families, but the unique thing is that I think they realize that you don't want to be the only person who's healthy and flourishing in a world of people who are miserable and suffering. Because I think it was Jeff Booth that said, you can't build walls high enough to keep people suffering out of your little citadel that is a paradise. And so the interest where I think Bitcoiners get to is, you don't want to be the only wealthy person in a miserable world. You want to be the person who gets their own life in order and has the excess capacity to help everyone around you get their lives in order so that you can all live well together, because we still need other people, right? Unless you want to, build your pencil and markers and build your house and do the plumbing in your toilet, we need to have community around us. Community creates resilience and strength. And I think, yeah, the people who have excess capacity and who have protected their time with sound money have extra time to help upgrade the world. And I think that's a really unique, beautiful thing that I see amongst Bitcoiners, amongst people who have transitioned to sound money, is they realize it's actually in our best interest selfishly to help others adopt sound money so that we can live in a better world and have a better world for our kids. And
Oh man,
it's pretty
amen,
special.
amen. And you know, if, like, I don't like to necessarily put people on a pedestal, and I'm not actually the biggest fan of Elon Musk in many ways, but he said a quote ages ago, and it's kind of hard to find sometimes, but he talks about how, like, if you're on a sinking ship and you have the patent to a bucket, you can keep that to yourself. It's totally fine. Keep it to yourself. Your ship's going to sink. And it's just like, or you can just give that information out and enable people to build buckets to bail out the ship, and hopefully that ship will continue to float and kind of find a safe haven. And so I think that the way that I see things is, in my mind, is that Bitcoin is almost like the patent to the bucket. We've got the society that is struggling, and it's kind of, we're being flooded by noise the whole time that makes it really hard for us to be able to identify the signal. And so it's just like the more we're able to spread this information, the more we're able to kind of be able to support other people in their journey, we're giving them a bucket to be able to start bailing out some of that noise so that they can start to identify the signal.
That's a great metaphor. Good place to end up. Thank you, Seb, for your time. Thanks, everyone, for being here and listening. Seb, where can people find your work and connect with you?
Oh man. And yeah, first off, I'd just say, Nick, I really appreciate you having me on. Like, I really enjoyed this conversation. I really enjoy kind of riffing with people that are curious and they want to just like share ideas and open-minded and we're malleable. And so in the end, it's just like, I really just appreciate individuals that are willing to put themselves out there and create like content such as this and to be able to talk to amazing individuals, because that's how I think the world grows and we find ourselves moving towards this kind of prosperity. But if people want to find me, I would say you can find me on my website, sebbunny.com, and bunny is BUNNEY. You can find me on Twitter or X at sebbunny. And yeah, I've got a book, The Hidden Cost of Money, and it talks about some of the things that we've discussed here, but ultimately, I never want price to be a barrier. So, if anyone is struggling financially, can't afford the book, feel free to just reach out and I'll send you the ebook for free. And I just believe that information should be freely accessible. But again, I really appreciate you having me on, Nick.
It's very generous, Seb. If you enjoyed this conversation, please share it, or you can donate to support the podcast at CanadianOrangeParty.com. Click donate. We only accept honest money. We don't take any dirty fiat. But the best thing you can do is just share this with someone who you think is at the point where they're ready to hear some of what we talked about and can find value in it. So thanks for listening. Wishing you all a great day. Ciao for now.